Producer Jeff, are you a planner or are you a doer?
I'm probably a planner. Definitely a planner.
Definitely a planner. Yeah. I'm a planner who just doesn't get around to the doing.
I think most people fall into that category.
Yeah, someday I will. I just haven't found time yet.
Like that book?
Like that book. There are three of them, actually. We'll get to that someday. Okay, so the guy we're talking to today, his name is Turner Sparks. He's all doer, like 100% doer. He has an idea. There's no thinking, planning, plotting, any of that. He just does, and it works out for him. And so I met him 10 years ago in Beijing, China, of all places, when he decided to bring ice cream trucks to China. That worked until it didn't. That's a great backstory. And these days, he's working as a stand-up comic.
He sounds interesting.
He's really awesome. So here's what I'm dying to ask. I'm dying to ask, how do you know if an idea is just a crazy idea or if it's just crazy enough? Have you ever wondered, how did they do that? I'm talking about the art of the follow-through. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and Dying to Ask is the podcast that gets me off a TV news set and into candid conversations with authors, entrepreneurs, and influencers I have been dying to talk to. So brace yourself. This is a verbal gut check about what it takes to go from idea to reality. And who knows, maybe along the way, you'll get some answers to questions you've been dying to ask. Turner Sparks, it's been a few years.
It has.
10 years.
10 years, right?
Last time I saw you, you were walking away from me on a street in Beijing.
According to the video.
According to the video, yeah. Okay, so like real quick story on how we know each other and how I happened to find out you were in town. I'm scrolling Facebook and I see an ad for a local comedy club and I see it says, you know, a local guy was an ice cream man in Beijing, now he's a comedian. And I think to myself, I knew an ice cream guy in Beijing 10 years ago when I was at the Olympics. And then I did a quick Google search. I'm like, he's my ice cream guy from Beijing. Well, okay, so let's go back in time. We met during the 2008 Beijing Olympics because your mother sent me an email.
Is that how it happened?
That's how it happened. Your mom sent me an email and she said, I really think it would be great if you met my son.
Oh my gosh.
He's selling ice cream in
China.
She's
a real promoter.
She is a total promoter, which is probably where you got it from. But how did you end up being the ice cream man in China?
So I was in Suzhou, China, which is outside of Shanghai, which is where we had the trucks. And I got into that because I was living in China for a year. Well, I moved there to teach English. I was there for one. I was going to teach English for a year and then move home. And my roommate from college, I went to school in Miami, Florida. My roommate, his grandfather started Mr. Softy Ice Cream Trucks, which is this big East Coast brand.
It's a total East Coast thing.
Total East Coast. They have 700 trucks up and down the
and
East Coast.
And it's soft serve ice cream.
It's like Dairy Queen on a truck.
Yeah.
So it's dip awesome. Cones, banana splits, sundaes, milkshakes, like all out of a soft serve. Yeah. So it's not frozen popsicles and stuff like that.
You know? No, this is the good stuff.
It's the real deal. Yeah. And so he...
You weren't selling froze toes.
No.
This is like the
Choco Tacos in this baby. This is all dip cones.
You want sprinkles? Yes!
Yeah, exactly. All the sprinkles you could get. And so his grandfather started this in the 1950s outside of Philadelphia. It became really big. And after I was in China just teaching English and I was going to move back. And then he called me, my friend Alex, and he was like, oh, we got to do business. We should do some business in China. We're going to do business. He was a business major. I was a journalism major. I was like, yeah. I was actually working at the paper at that time in Suzhou as the only foreigner working at this Chinese paper. And then they found out I worked there and they fired me because they couldn't have foreigners, apparently. I was there for 6 months. The boss never knew.
He didn't figure out you weren't Chinese?
No, or he never also read his own paper because I was writing for them once a week, like twice a week. I was getting articles published. He clearly didn't look at his own paper.
Well, you know, death in the newspaper.
Exactly.
Something like that. Okay, so you're over there. You're working for the paper.
Yes.
And Alex is like, we got to do business.
Exactly. But he didn't know what. He was like, oh, we'll sell, like, they'd sell fake handbags. We could sell them.
Because no one's doing that there.
Yeah, he's like, send them back to me. I'll sell them on the street. I'm like, I think that's illegal. So then I had seen, they had McDonald's in China. They have it all over China. And McDonald's and KFC were basically the only places in China that sold soft ice cream. And they had these huge lines. It got so popular that this is like 15 years ago, that McDonald's had to open a window outside of the McDonald's, almost like a drive-through window, but for walking, that was only serving the soft serve. So that they could get those people out of the store because the store needed to be able to sell hamburgers and everything, get them into a whole other location. And it was 25 people at all times waiting to get McDonald's soft ice cream.
It is good.
It was good, but it was also just vanilla cones. Maybe, I don't even know if they had chocolate. It was very basic. It was like a basic menu.
Right.
And so I thought, this is exactly what Mr. Softy does, except way better. Mr. Softy's way better, and Mr. Softy does it on a truck. So if people are going to just like stand outside a store, if they see a truck driving around the neighborhood, it'll like blow their minds.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, we should do this. So we did it, and we built that business up. And
So who goes to Alex's grandpa and says, hey, we've got this idea. Let's go to China.
Okay. So Alex's grandpa had retired by this point. It was his dad. Alex's dad was in charge.
Okay.
And so we went and met with him. We had this big old plan. We're like, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to go there. And he's going to invest in us and all this stuff. And we'll run it for him. This will be awesome. And so we went and we met with him in Philadelphia. And I put on my suit like that I wore to prom, whatever, 5 years earlier. Or I was 23 years old.
Right.
And with no business background.
No.
And now journalism.
And a questionable newspaper background at that point.
Yeah, communications major. I was like, I knew sender and receiver or whatever, but that was it. And so then, so we meet with him, we give him this whole pitch, and we're like, so all you have to do is give us money and we'll go do this. And he was like, okay, well, I think the idea is great, but I'm giving you zero money. He's like, but if you want to do it, you can buy the rights to me. We can negotiate a deal where you can get the franchise rights from me, and then you can develop the franchise in China. So, for example, if somebody wanted to do Mr. Softy in Sacramento, they might get the rights to Sacramento or like Fair Oaks or Rancho Cordova. You get an area
right.
that you can exclusively develop so that for a certain number of years, as long as you put in five trucks in 5 years or something, they won't sell it off to someone else, right? So you kind of don't have competition. So he's like, you guys can do that, but your territory will just be China.
All
and I'm
China.
Like, all right. Sounds good.
So the two of you went off and did it.
Yeah, the two of us, and then we had a third partner, a Chinese guy named Jeffrey Tai, who worked with us, and he had done a bunch of business in China before.
Because this was general. Really when, like, this is, you know, 2007, 2008. This is when, like, the franchising of China was really, you started hearing people talking about, like, hey, there's a lot of money to be made there.
Exactly. It was just 2007 was when we opened, and we kind of made this deal in late 2005, 2006, and then opened in 2007, and everything was coming in. Dairy
right.
Queen, Baskin-Robbins, Haagen-Dazs. Haagen-Dazs is already over there, but any like American Cold Stone was opening as we were opening. Any one of those, anything. I think like Baja Fresh was there for
right.
a while. They're not even here anymore,
so
I don't think.
When I met you, it was August of 2008, and like you were full on into it. And I did an entire story about people going over and doing these franchising things. And everybody that I interviewed was like you. They were 20-something guy mm-hmm. who was like, I'm going to own China.
Exactly.
And it was like I talked to the Annie Ann's Pretzel Kid.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember him?
Yeah.
And I talked to you about the ice cream. And then I kind of wondered, like, what's going to happen? And what happened was a lot of you guys were really successful.
Yeah, it went well for a
until
while.
It didn't. we'll get to that. But what, like, how successful was this in its heyday? And what was it like to be the ice cream man in China?
It was pretty cool. So I was in Suzhou. I was in one city. And eventually we were in Shanghai for a little while. But so the city we were in is 8 million people. And Shanghai's down the road, that's 22 million people. And then in our area, which was the size of New York, the state of New York, there was 100 million people.
Wow.
And so there was the idea of like owning China was like, that's so far off and probably unnecessary. Like 1.5 billion people, five times the size of America. It's like, first, let's focus on the city. Because with 8 million people, you can go up to 20 or 30 trucks before you even have to leave and go to the next city, you know? And so for us at our heyday, we had 10 trucks and two stores that was all going great. And opening the first day we opened, I was really concerned if people were going to know what an ice cream truck was or not, you know, or even because there hadn't been one. There had been one in Shanghai a long time ago, but besides that, nothing in all of China.
So you start driving down the street. Do you? I mean, like, are you playing the little song?
Yeah. And also, what was odd was the meeting to get the permits. You had to get permits to have these trucks, and no one had done ice cream trucks. No one had done. There's no food trucks or anything, and so. explaining to someone, which you don't realize how ridiculous it is until you're having to explain the idea of an ice cream truck to someone who's never heard of it. And you're like sitting in a meeting with all these government officials, these Chinese government guys smoking cigarettes and everything. And they're going, okay, so what do you want to do? And you're like, I want to do an ice cream truck. And they're like, all right, well, what's that? Because they know a truck and they know ice cream, but they're like, why would those two things go together? Like a truck driving the street. You're like, well, we're going to sell truck out of the ice cream. And I sell ice cream out of the truck. And I remember their first question is like, why? Can't you just do a store or what? And then that one guy was like, I have a question. He's like, how are you going to keep the ice cream cold? Like, there's just no concept of it. And also, it's ridiculous. And then they all.
And you're like 23.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And some kid coming in. And I remember their biggest concern was that we were going to just be running over kids. They're like, wait,
they're
so
your customers.
Yeah. They're like, wait, them. So your business is to sell ice cream to children out of a moving vehicle?
Yes.
And this is safe? And I was like, I don't know. People do it in America.
We don't lose too many of them.
Yeah. And so then I had to go and get video of our trucks running in America. And there it had someone had just opened a truck in Japan. And so I had a video of that truck and I had video of the trucks in America just to conceptually show them what I was even talking about.
This is crazy.
Yeah. It would be like someone like China coming to you and be like, okay, we're going to open a dumpling castle. And you're like, why? Why not just a store? You know, why do you need a castle? Why can't... It was that foreign to them that this would be a concept of an idea. And so finally they gave us the permits and we got it all going. And the first night we opened our first store, my parents were there and a bunch of friends actually from Sacramento came over. And it was just immediately, we went to this parking lot on a lake, which we had a permit for outside of like a bar street. It was kind of on a lake. And we parked there. And it was immediately 20 people on both sides of the window, lines, for the next, like, 4 hours. For as long, we were there from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Wow.
And it was just slammed. And we set out there, and it was just amazing. You know, like, oh, my gosh, this is working with no marketing or advertising or anything. Just, like, people see it, and they're like, sounds good. Boom, getting it. Yeah. And then it was cool. Then from that, we expanded the menu, and we started doing bigger cones and crazy flavors. We had green tea ice cream and red bean rice cake ice cream and
red bean and rice cake ice cream.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it sounds gross.
It does.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be culturally insensitive.
No,
but that
no,
sounds
no.
Horrendous.
It sounds gross, but actually, yeah. So then. Interesting, skipping way ahead, I just filmed something 3 or 4 months ago in New York that's going to be on this PBS show coming up, and they had us serve Mr. Softee China flavors on a Mr. Softee truck in New York.
Interesting.
To American people.
And?
To see what they would think. And the favorite one was the red bean and rice cake
really?
Ice cream. Yeah, but it was immediately like, people like, this sounds gross. I'm like, just try it. They try it. They're like, that's actually really good.
And isn't that funny?
Like, coming back. Yeah.
Gosh, look at you. You're like an international peace broker.
Exactly. I know.
One soft serve at a time.
Yeah.
Okay, so the ice cream's going great. What made, until it isn't, and we'll get there. What made you think that dream would work? Like, did you know right away that thing was going to work, or were you just throwing it out in the wind?
50-50.
That's honest.
Because you get to, I mean, it was a hunch. It was
based on what?
Nothing. I mean, based on I had seen these people outside of this McDonald's, and I'm like, well, if they like that, they're going to like this, you know? And I just thought the idea of a truck was cool, that it hadn't been done. It had worked here. Why wouldn't it work there? I mean, like, it's a culture that liked ice cream, and at that time, and I don't know if still, but definitely for those 10 or 15 years from 2000 to 2015, or late 90s to early, like 2012, 13, whatever, really into anything new and foreign.
Mm-hmm.
Just anything, it was cool. You know, like, oh, wow. It's like how, like, I don't know, what's, like, Thai food is here, or what's, like, the food. Anytime there's a new Ethiopian food, people are like, there's a new Ethiopian restaurant. No one even knows what that is, but, like, we got to try it because it's new. That's how, like, anything was out there, you know?
Right.
Just, like, cool. It's some new thing. And Chinese people were starting, there was a big middle class. It was growing. People were starting to get money and travel and explore the world. And we're just open, watching foreign movies and just open to any kind of crazy concept.
So how big did this thing get?
So it got so all those trucks were doing really well. And also what I didn't know until it happened was that people had seen American movies for years and seen ice cream trucks and even Mr. Softee trucks in all these movies. And so then you're seeing something on TV, and then when it's actually in your town, you're like, oh my gosh, like we have one of those now too. And all the local media was covering it and everything. It was a cool story.
Were you kind of like the ice cream celebrity there?
I was the ice cream celebrity. I do remember I was in an elevator one time, and these high school girls were in there, and they were like, oh, 你觉得, Tasha Ranxin 先生? Which means that's Mr. Softee. And the other guy was like, doing them a lot? Like, really? Really? And then I looked at her and I was like, yeah, hey, what's up? And they're like, oh my God, you speak Chinese? Because I was on like local news and all, you know what I mean? Like, so. There was a chance you could have seen me in the paper or something like that. But then what was really cool was that I did notice, do you know how, like, I would compare Mr. Softee on the East Coast to how In-N-Out Burger is here.
Right.
So where it's everywhere here, but it's not everywhere in the United States. But people who are from the West Coast, you almost, because you live here, you almost think it must be. Or even if you know it's not, you just assume it
will be.
Everyone right. knows it, right? And yeah, it will be. And the same thing on the East Coast. Like when I talk to people in New York, the idea that I did Mr. Softee in China, they just assume I'm a billionaire.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh my God.
Turner, are you?
Yeah, no.
No. You'd be the first billionaire we had on the show.
I'd be the first billionaire still doing stand-up comedy.
Well, yeah, that would be, that's the next part of the story. Okay, so at some point though, Mr. Softee sees some rougher times because
yes.
your business got so big
yeah.
that people really started noticing, and that might have been part of the problem.
Yeah, so in our city and in our area, our territory, whatever, we were really big, really popular. Everyone knew us. And so I remember, so people would go out of town to like other cities around China, and they'd come back and they'd tell me, they're like, I went there and those people had never heard of Mr. Softee. Isn't that crazy? I'm like, oh, it's regional still, you know? But in the region, it was really popular. And that was a problem. Because you want to be popular as a business. If I give any advice to business people, aspiring business people in China, get popular, but don't get too popular. There's a certain level. You still want to be under the radar from the government.
Gosh, it sounds like high school.
Yes.
You don't want to be in the popular clique, but you don't want to be in the really not popular clique.
Exactly.
You want to be the sweet spots in the middle.
In the middle, exactly.
Yeah.
And the problem is, because if you get too popular, you get on their radar, and then the local government doesn't become your regulators anymore. They become your competition. Because they're like, oh, we could do that. And so that's what happened.
They did?
Yeah.
The Chinese government got into ice cream trucks?
Yeah. So... the local government. What happened was people started working for us after, this is like 2012 or 13. So we started 2000. So this is 6 or 7 years later. And when we weren't doing, in the early days, when it was up and down, we had no problems. But then once it started going really well, I remember I was in a meeting one time, and this tax bureau guy called me into a meeting, and he was like, he's like, I just want to talk to you about your taxes. I've been going over what you guys report. And we reported absolutely everything.
So you had to file like Chinese tax reports there?
Yeah.
Okay.
We filed Chinese taxes. And then if you're a foreign-owned company, you get audited every year no matter what.
Okay.
And so you're watched.
In Chinese.
In Chinese.
Super fun.
And so, yeah. So the tax bureau comes into your office for however long it takes them. Sometimes they're there for like 2 or 3 weeks. And you have to buy them lunch every day. It's ridiculous.
I was like,
you can go through all my files. I'm not buying you lunch. Lunch, unless I can expense it.
Did they eat the ice cream?
I think they did. They had free ice cream.
Did.
Yeah, and so we're totally, everything's by the book. He calls me in one day, and he goes, he's like, yeah, I was just, there's a Mr. Softee truck. So I've looked over your taxes. I see what you report, and there's a Mr. Softee truck outside my door, and it has 20 people all times, every day, at all times, waiting to get ice cream. So I don't think you're paying your correct taxes. And I'm like, this is your scientific mode of figuring out. First of all, I was, and I had nothing to hide. And so I was like, dude, I pay my taxes. Those people are also all paying $2 or $3 at a time. I have a friend who works in a building next door who just signed a $100,000 contract, but there's not 100,000 people outside his door. So you're not auditing him right now.
Right.
You just see people and you think it's me. And so I gave this explanation. I was also like, I pay everything. You can come. If you want to come audit me again, come do it, which he didn't want to. He just assumed I wasn't paying taxes. And so he goes, okay, well, I just called you in because I just want to be friends. And I think that there's a way we can do this to where it would be better for everyone, and we could just be have a more friendly cooperation.
Translation.
Yeah, he wanted me to pay him money so that he wouldn't be auditing me, so I didn't have to pay taxes.
I would have traded him ice cream.
I know. I didn't do it. I was like, nah, what are you? I was like, no, I didn't know if you were going to do that. And then I left, and I was like, later, the next year when taxes came up, I was like, maybe I should have done that.
So what's the ultimate thing that happened with it then?
So ultimately, the government, the local government, saw how we were doing well. Local government, so not like the national, this wasn't like a bureau thing. The local government officials tried to figure out eventually, like, how did he get his permits? They were in a meeting, they were like, how did Turner get his permits? And somebody was like, oh, well, we gave it to him 10 years ago or 5 years, 8 years ago. And they're like, oh, so what if we just don't give it to him? Can we do this? And they were like, oh, yeah. And so they got their relatives to come work for us for a little while without us knowing for like 6-8 months. And then we start stealing from us. And then when we'd catch them stealing, they would quit. And then like 2 weeks later, they would have their own ice cream truck on the street.
No.
Yeah. And that's when I started to be like, wait, what's going on? Because it takes 2 to 3 months to build these trucks. And they're also really expensive to build.
Yeah.
And typically the guys who drove for us were long distance truck drivers that our offer was like, you don't have to go on the road anymore. You can stay local. You make more money.
Eat ice cream all day.
But it wasn't people who could then just afford $100,000 or whatever it costs to go build a truck. And so there was clearly funding from somewhere. And when they started popping up, I didn't know what was behind it at this point. So we called the local government. We're like, hey, this is going on. They don't have permits. We had all these permits. Like, can you just tell them to go leave because they don't have the regular permits, or make them get permits? And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then they would just do nothing. And then that would happen for a couple of years. And eventually we found out that it was all, they were behind it. The local government was behind it.
Wow.
And so then, we still had permits. We still had our own permits at this point, but they kind of popped up as competitors, I guess, mm-hmm. you would say. But they looked exactly like our truck. They sold all the same flavors. They were driven by our drivers who had been working for us 2 weeks earlier. And they would park right next to us. They parked right next
Seriously?
To us. Yes, like within, like bumper to bumper, like obnoxiously close.
Wow.
And eventually I called the government enough and complained. I was calling them every week to complain and complain and complain that we had permits and they didn't have permits. That's all I wanted. Just regulate the permits. And they're like, okay, so we've come up, finally, they're annoyed with me. So they come up with a solution. Like, we got a solution. You said they don't have permits. You have permits and they don't. So we're just going to take away your permits. And then no one has permits, so you can't call us anymore. And then that was the end of the business.
And that was the end of Mr. Softy.
Yeah, so we closed it. Sold off all the assets to all of our drivers at that time were good. So we sold all the assets to them, and they went home and drove ice cream trucks in their towns and everything. And that's the story.
It takes a special kind of person to do morning news, don't you think?
I think so.
And by special, I mean not right.
Yeah, there's definitely something crazy about all of us.
All of us. We love getting up in the middle of the night. We love starting the day really early. The news goes on at 4 a.m. now, 4 a.m. to 9 a.m. 5 hours of news.
That's a long time.
That is a very long time. You know how much time that is? 300 minutes.
That's a lot of minutes.
18,000 seconds.
That's a lot of seconds.
That's a lot of seconds. It's a lot of information.
Gonna start singing Rent right now?
I might. That is where I got the idea. That's a lot of news. That's a lot of weather. That's a lot of traffic. It's a lot of fun.
At 4 in the morning.
At 4 in the morning. And it all starts in the middle of the night. Join us.
Chinese government shuts down Mr. Softy. But meanwhile, you've been doing something else on the side, right?
Yes. So they shut it down in 2015. So that was kind of 2016. We totally closed it. So it was a 10-year Mr. Softy run, which is not bad.
Which, you know.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good. You probably never want to eat ice cream again.
We'll get into that. I found out recently, after being back in America for a year and a half, whatever, 2 years, that I can't handle dairy anymore. It's a real disaster.
You're making that up.
I'm not. I wish I was. It's so depressing. I'm fully American now. And gluten as well. It's a whole disaster. Never had a problem for my entire life in China. And then I'm back here. So I was doing comedy the end of 2009. A friend and I had always wanted to do stand-up comedy. There was nowhere to do it in mainland China. There was some club in Hong Kong, which is a long ways away. Nowhere in the mainland.
But the idea of like a punchline or something like that didn't really exist there. There was nothing like that, right?
Well, they had their own, this thing called Shangsheng, which is two-man comedy like Abbott and Costello. Like two guys go on stage, they do a back and forth, but it's scripted, and a lot of it's like a script that a lot of people will use. So it's really well planned out, okay. Like old-timey 1940s.
It's like choreographed. It's like doing covers.
Exactly. Yeah.
Did you want to do comedy because where you were living, the stuff that was happening around you was just so funny? Because I find traveling, there are things that happen to you as an American in other parts of the world where you're like, I can't believe I'm experiencing this right
yeah,
now.
This is ridiculous,
this
right?
is ridiculous. It's like total yeah. observational humor, and usually you are the butt of everyone else's jokes because totally. You look just as funny to them. But was it that was driving it, or had you just always liked comedy?
Well, I'd always liked it, but that made it easy to write.
Yeah.
At the beginning. But no, I always loved it. Like growing up, Norm Macdonald was doing the news on
yes.
Saturday Night Live. He's my favorite comedian of all time. And I just loved how dry and like saying something that wasn't being said on other parts of TV. You know, I mean, some of it's obviously scripted. And then when you see like Norm Macdonald go do stand-up or something, even on TV, it's like, oh my God, this guy can say anything. And as long as it's funny, you can say whatever you want.
The thing about China is you can't say whatever you want a lot of the time.
True. Well, you can't talk politics about the Chinese government, right?
It's not advised.
Yeah.
No.
And still not advised.
No, still not advised.
Yeah.
So who was the guy that you wanted to do comedy with, and what'd you guys do?
So it's just a friend of mine who, at that time, he and I were just like at a bar one night, or our friend had just opened a bar, and mm-hmm. our friend was from San Luis Obispo.
God, how many good ideas start with two guys at a bar?
Not a lot, but this one was
well, awesome. How many ideas start?
A lot.
Yeah.
And then they never happen.
What we need to do.
I know what we can do.
That actually sounds like how both of my
That's
ideas
That's how
started.
This podcast started.
Yeah.
So where do you guys start doing comedy?
So our friend opened a bar, and it was a small, like, little dive bar. And we were sitting in there one night about a month after he opened, and we were talking, we were drunk, and we were talking about how we should do stand-up comedy. We both loved it. We'd always wanted to do it. And he heard us behind the bar. He's like, hey, I'll put a stage in if you guys will commit to doing it. If you'll commit tonight to me, then I'll put a stage and lighting in right there. And so we're like, yeah, sure, whatever. We'll do it. Sounds awesome. And then the next day he called us at noon and he's like, hey, you wake up. The stage is already in. Because it's China. You can do anything in like 2 hours.
Right.
And so he had a stage built that morning and lighting. And he's like, you guys are on in 3 weeks. So marketing's going out today. You better put the show together. So we were just forced to do a show. So we both begged our roommates. We got our roommates to do it with us. No, we had no idea what we were doing. Everyone, it was the four of us. And we're like, just go up. And none of us had ever done it before. So like, just go talk for as long as you want until you're done. And then the next guy will come up and talk until he's done. But it was, so we do it. It's packed because, first of all, it's free. And then
that
second
helps.
Of all, yeah, there's nothing to do in town.
Yeah.
And even like TV, you can't. Foreign TV's all blocked. You can't watch that. So there's no real entertainment except fake DVDs, like bootleg DVDs of some Stallone movie.
Or going down to Mr. Softy and having a soft serve.
Exactly.
What else are you
going to
do on a Friday
night? Or going
to
see your friends make idiots of themselves.
So what did you guys talk about?
So it was a lot of that. It was a lot of all that observational expat crazy in this crazy country. And it was a lot of the first... It was funny. So we were doing scooter. Like, scooters is a big thing in China.
Mm-hmm.
These, like, electric bikes. And so, which I know that they've just now opened in Sacramento.
Yes.
Because my friend, actually, Alex, who I started Mr. Softy with, he now works for Uber. And he's in charge of the rollout for Uber's bikes. And he said Sacramento's their biggest market. He was here for 3 weeks, like, a few weeks ago, getting all those
I have an idea for him.
Red bikes in.
Sell ice cream from one of those scooters.
Genius.
You can have it.
Genius. That's
him,
free?
That's
but
a freebie.
How do you keep it cool?
That's a freebie. Well, that's for Alex to figure out. I'm not going to give Alex everything.
Yeah, you're not doing the details.
I'm not doing the details. I'm just the idea person. That's what this whole podcast is about.
Exactly.
So you guys get up there, and it sounds like it went okay.
So we're doing scooter jokes in 2009 about how they're so dangerous. Right now, it's amazing I can actually do them now in America. No one knows, but they're so dangerous because there's no motor. So you're walking down the street at night, and some guy, you don't even hear someone. There's like, boom, like whizzing right by you. I got clipped so many times. By people, because there's no warning that they're coming.
Who's your audience? Is it Chinese? Is it expats? Who's there?
It's a mix. Anyone who speaks English, because these shows are in English. So that's expats, but it doesn't just mean Americans. There's people, Germans, Russians, Italians, all types of European, Australian, Canadian, Mexican, American. It was this crazy time when everyone's there because business is there. So everyone from around the world's going. going to China, and they're at work all day, but then at night they have nothing to do. It's this real, like, gold rush mentality. Like, you come in, and then there's no entertainment. So, yeah, sure, we'll go see the comedy show. You know? And
it almost didn't even matter if you were good.
It didn't matter at all.
No.
And we weren't. We weren't good, and they still laughed, and then the guy sold, like, tons. He had his biggest night, so then after that first night, he's like, you guys are doing this. It was crazy. He said, because it was free, he's like, I can't pay you guys. It's a free show, but if you'll do this, you can all have free drinks all night.
That'll make
which
the
is
show
like,
better.
They don't do that for the comedians. In America, it's like, maybe you get a free drink, and then you get paid a little bit or something. In New York, I mean, I get, like, $50 and a drink or something.
Yeah.
This guy was like, whatever you need just to keep this motor running.
So is this how the Kung Fu Comedy Club starts?
This is how it started. So we did that. A year later, my friend Andy, who's all Australian, started a similar thing in Shanghai, 50 miles down the road. We didn't know each other, but someone connected us pretty quickly because, hey, you're doing that, and you're doing that. And in my city, there's 8 or 10 people doing it. In his city, there's 8 or 10 people doing it. So it's so small that we just combined pretty much immediately. And we started doing these shows around Shanghai and Suzhou.
So were the shows called Kung Fu Comedy Club?
Yeah. So we just immediately, it was called Kung Fu Comedy. And it was a mix of Chinese comedians doing it in English. And then people from around the world. There's Egyptian people, Russian, German, whatever. All these people doing comedy, but in English. So we do that for a couple years. And then we're just pop-ups at different bars around these towns. You know, we'll come in for a night and run a show. And then we started flying comedians over from the U.S. to headline. And we started building, we'd built enough cities around China that we figured we could put on a tour where Andy and I went out and opened for them. And then they would come headline and do an hour, and we would sell the tickets and kind of run the whole back end of the business plus open the show. And then we would pay them to come out, do the show with us. So those are called Kung Fu Comedy Tours. And we started doing those.
I mean, like, you're making this up as you go along.
Yeah.
And so it worked.
Yeah, so we did those in 2012. We've had people. Ari Shaffir is one of the bigger names we've had out. He had a TV show on Comedy Central for a long time.
Yeah.
But once we started doing a couple of these, basically everyone wanted to do them, all these American comedians.
Why? Why were they so drawn to it?
Because they could all say, well, I could go to Detroit for the 19th time and play the Chuckle Hut. Or I could go to China and have this crazy life experience, you know, and do comedy. And we paid relatively well. And we paid for everything, plus 5-star hotels, the flights, and you got paid to do all the shows, and you got a week in China to go. I mean, most of these people think I never thought they would go to do their act, but go do it in China, you know. And so it just became this really cool thing to do. And they would come back and tell everyone how awesome the trip was. Plus, Andy and I were almost like their tour guides around the country. We spoke Chinese. We go with them and we could get all the taxis and order food and whatever, you know. Just see that it's a crazy way to tour a country. As you're the person people are coming to see, but also during the day you're going and seeing sights and everything like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Jeff, did you know that KCRA3's Leticia Rodas likes musicals?
I did not know that.
You know how I knew that?
How do you know that?
KCRA app, what? News team bios. It's one of the fun features you'll find on the app in addition to your news, your weather. I know you love the weather.
Weather's very important.
Super important to Jeff. He needs to know what to wear in the morning. Sartorial splendor, that is his thing. KCRA app, it is free. It's like having KCRA in your pocket. And if you enable those push notifications, you find out breaking news as we know it.
That sounds great.
Well, go get it.
I will.
I just can't believe you then took this idea and you were able to turn it into a tour and then you start touring Asia with this thing.
Yeah.
What was the one you did about Rambo? You had like a Rambo theme at one point.
Yes. So I did a tour one time because all these, as Andy and I were doing this in Shanghai and Suzhou, unbeknownst to us around 2009, 10, 11, all these other people were doing it. These little communities were popping up all around Asia.
Yeah, so because they were tired of copying your ice cream trucks. So they're like, he's having way more fun now.
Yeah.
Like, what's Turner doing now that we can rip off?
No, these guys weren't ripping up. These were in whole different countries. They were just simultaneously all these clubs were. So it got to the point where by 2012 or 13 you could tour all around Asia doing comedy. And so I did one tour where I went to Burma, Vietnam, and Cambodia, and I called it the Places Rambo Attack Tour. That was fantastic. And I was like, yeah, next time I'm doing Afghanistan and Seattle, finish off the tour. And then it was, I wanted to do the Places Rocky Fought tour. So as the next one, which I was saying, I just did, I was in Philly like a month ago.
So like when you're doing all that, is there an end goal at that point? Are you just still just having fun and
it was
just seeing where
fun.
It's going to go?
That's all it was, because at that time, Mr. Softy was going great. So this was really like a side business that had started as a hobby, and I started making a little money out of it. But it was more like these we'd fly these comedians over once a month, and for 3 or 4 days, Andy and I would go out with them around China, 5 days or something. And then they would have a couple days to hang out in Shanghai. So really it was 4 or 5 days out of the month I would be out, and usually only even one of the stops was in my city. So I was only actually away from work like 2 days. So it wasn't taking so much time away. At nights, I would work all day. At nights, I would go do open mics and write material, but it was totally a hobby. And then even when I started touring around Asia, it was still a hobby because they were fun and I was getting better and I was doing really well. There was these competitions in Hong Kong and I was doing well in those. I got second in one of those one time. And but I still thought Mr. Softy was my business, you know? And then
you're the ice cream man.
I was the ice cream man. Yeah, I was getting recognized in elevators by teenagers. And so then when the Mr. Softy thing totally, so then also in 2014 or 15, Annie and I opened a club, like a full-time club called Kung Fu Comedy Club in Shanghai. And now that became a 5-day-a-week club. And then Andy's just started running that club on his own because I had to stick at Mr. Softy. That's when it became a full-time job. And so he did that full-time, but we still did the tours together. And yeah, I was just getting better at stand-up, but really still thought of it as a fun outlet. Like, I played music all growing up around Sacramento, played in bands, wrote songs. So this creative outlet I always needed. And I just thought comedy was a good way to replace that from the music I'd written earlier.
No. But when ice cream melts, for
when ice cream
term.
Melts, that should be, that's the name of the book.
Yes! Yes! Ice cream melts. Oh my God, that's really good. You can have that one too. So when that goes away, like, do you go all in on the comedy then?
All in on comedy, yeah.
Because now you've really got some funny material.
Yes. So I started, so I could write all about that. So when that happened, we closed it. And the first thing I did was write the first draft of this book, which I'm now kind of working on. But I spent we closed on a Friday. On Monday, I started writing this book, and within three months, had a first draft done.
And the book is about your experience.
About my business life in China. So it's the whole Mr. Softy and then into the Kung Fu comedy stuff, which actually that story wasn't even done yet until really recently. The Kung Fu comedy side, the comedy club. Because also that was the first comedy club in China. I guess obviously. I don't know if obviously is the right term, but it was. And now we're doing Chinese shows kind of came up. So meaning people wanted to do it in Chinese comedians were like, can we do the show at your club but in our language? Like, of course. That was the whole point from the beginning. So now we have Chinese shows and English shows. And even just in the 2 years since I've been gone, I went back a few months ago and there's these on major TV, they have roasts like we have in America.
Yeah.
And all these with Chinese, they're roasting these celebrities, and all these Chinese comedians are the people 2 years earlier who were starting in our club. And now they're all famous.
Wow.
And so it really took off. And then for my own career, yeah, that's when I just went full on into stand-up comedy. I toured as much for the next 6 months, just all around Asia as much as I could. And that's kind of when it got closed. That's when my wife and I decided we were going to move to New York.
Interesting. Now, your wife is Chinese, right?
My wife is Chinese. Yeah. And she's from Suzhou, the town I was living in. And her family's still there. And she had lived in the U.S. for a little while in college and then lived in the U.K. for graduate school. And I met her when she came back. So she knew the United States and everything. When we decided it was time to go, we decided let's go to New York. That's the best place for stand-up and just go all in.
Does she find you funny?
Luckily, she does.
That's good.
We met at a show.
Did you really?
So, yeah.
Wow.
If she wouldn't have found me funny, I don't think we ever would have met.
No, that's probably true. So when you go to New York, I mean, I can see, like, if you're the only guy who's up there doing comedy in a town, by definition or default, you're the funniest guy around, right?
Yeah.
But New York is completely different. So what was that experience like then, trying to take your act?
Well, you find out you're not very good.
Did you?
I had a lot of this. I've been doing it for 6 years at that point, which I think is a good base to go to New York with, because New York's obviously the best of the best for stand-up. There's thousands, I'd say 5,000 comedians in New York, and about 300 can work regularly doing it. And so the level of competition is crazy.
Where do you even go when you get to New York? Like, where do you go to start?
So I, luckily, from running all these tours, I had met all these comedians, these New York-based comedians, for the last few years because we've been touring around China with them all. And so I had met a lot of their agents and managers and all that stuff and club owners. And so I had a base of contacts when I got there of people who really helped me out, like helped me get into this club or get into that club or meet to start my own show somewhere. So I wasn't coming with nothing. I was coming with enough friends who were ready. Like, once you get here, let me know and I'm going to take you around. And so then it's just a matter of being funny and doing well. And I was doing an hour. So I'll give you an example. I was doing an hour around China, touring with headlining, performing an hour. When I got to New York, it's not necessarily that you're not funny. It's that what you were talking about there is not applicable to here. Because my act was pretty much about being this foreign American guy in Asia, but then you're not in Asia anymore.
Right.
And so that crutch is gone. So you have to really start writing about yourself. And that's how you just become a way better comedian, because you're forced to become more creative. But so when I, that hour that I had in Asia, when I got to New York, 10 minutes of it worked.
Well, then you can add in all the whole communist China stuff stealing your trucks.
Exactly. You can finally talk about that.
So what kills it in New York about your experience in China? Like, what do people love hearing about?
I talk about the Mr. Softy truck.
Yeah.
And that actually, even that kind of stuff, it takes the way you would tell that story. I'm trying to think of exactly how, but the way you would tell that story in China is more of a shortcut than how you can tell it in the U.S. You have to explain what it is a little bit. You also have to, so I start a lot of sets by, I have a bit where I can speak Chinese in it, one of my opening jokes. And I do that to let people know that I'm not lying. Because I found in New York, the first couple months I was there, the audience didn't believe me when I said that I lived in China for 12 years and had all these experiences. They would come up to me after and be like, "Well, that's crazy. You made up. Did that really happen? Or are you just making that up?" I'm like,
Why would you make that up?
I have no idea, but that was the overall. And so the minute I would speak Chinese at the beginning, that would justify, like, I'm telling the truth. And then immediately the rest of the set started going better.
It seems to me that your whole life, or at least adulthood, has been about, like, having an idea, having a dream, and then just doing it, not thinking about it a whole lot.
Yeah, true.
Not planning for it. So what's your advice to somebody who has one of these wild hairs? Like, how do you know if an idea is just crazy or if it's just crazy enough?
So you have to prove it. So the first year of Mr. Softy was we put enough money together to build a truck, one truck and a store. And that was kind of through our own money and through friends and loans and stuff. And then that first year, it went really well. And we used those numbers and that real result to raise $1.5 million to build way more. But no one would have given us that off the bat. We had to go prove it on our own. And the same thing with the comedy club. We started doing our own shows and built those up. And then because we had enough of a base, we started booking these comedians. They wanted to come over. And then we got to open our club. And someone invested a little in the club. And so you kind of have to prove all this stuff on. Like, just having an idea is not enough. You have to also put, it's a lot of work behind it too, right? So it's believing in yourself, but it's also putting in the hours when no one's gonna, like, sitting and waiting for someone to give you an opportunity will never happen.
Do you ever think you can't do something?
Sure, I can't be like the Olympics. I don't think I could go run a marathon or something. But no, most stuff, if I'm passionate about the idea, if I really like the idea and it's something I'm really interested in, I think I can figure out a way to do it.
You have a great podcast too.
Thank you.
It's really great. It's called Lost in America.
Lost in America. So we have comedians and journalists on who've done something crazy around the world and have come back and they tell us the story. Or we have foreign comedians or journalists who live in America and tell us how crazy America is from their perspective. And their outsider perspective of us.
So that's a great way to keep up with you. What are some other good ways for people to keep up with you on social media, or how do we find you when you're out on tour?
Yeah, so turnersparks.com is my website. I put all my tour dates on there. You can also email me through that, and that'll put me on my mailing list. If you're in Sacramento, I usually send out an email like a month before whenever I'm coming back to do a show. And on Twitter, Turner B. Sparks. On Instagram, Turner Sparks.
Turner, I'm so glad your mom emailed me 10 years ago.
It's amazing.
Honestly, like, that's why we're sitting here today, is because your mom emailed me and said, you ought to go do a story about my son.
That's hilarious.
And here we are.
Here we are.
Hey, best of luck to you and your wife as you start this new life back in America.
Thank you so much.
Things are going great, and I can't wait to see, like, what ridiculous idea you come up with next.
We'll see. Thanks.
So unlike the Mr. Softy story, Kung Fu Comedy actually has a really happy ending.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They sold it to Live Nation.
Well, there you go.
How about that?
Better than the Chinese government coming in.
Better than the Chinese government coming in and taking it over. Yeah, it's pretty good. So best of luck to Turner Sparks. And thank you to everybody who's been reviewing the podcast. Want to hear one of my favorites so far?
Let's hear it.
Awesome, fun, informative, perfect for a 40-minute elliptical workout.
Very succinct.
Very succinct. Anaerobic, apparently. And then here's one that came in from Carolyn. Loved it. I know you say that there's a producer. I love his role, but the point is none of this feels scripted. Let me tell you something.
It's not.
None of it is. Thanks to everybody who's been leaving us those great reviews. We love it. You can find us on, of course, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. Leave a review, share, subscribe.
You can find us on Instagram.
And Twitter
and all that fun stuff.
You're on the Insta now at
Producer Jeff.
Producer Jeff. He's crazy on there. You can find me on Instagram at Run Read Sip. On Facebook at KCRA Deirdre. On Twitter at KCRA Fitz, which is way easier to find because you don't have to spell as much. Anywhere else we can find you?
I'm. What am I on Twitter? I have a Twitter, I think. Jeff and TV.
Jeff.
Real original.
Clearly, it's really active too. Anyway, thanks for keeping up, suggesting guests. We'll talk to you next time.